1,000 wounded. Our correspondent, Dero Bala, Gada Ibrahim, joined us earlier, provided us with more on U.S.-Israeli genocidal war on the besieged strip. Here she is.
The Israeli occupation army targeted whole residential blocks belonging to families like Hamad, Ba'lusha, Zakut, Al-Husari, and Al-Khudari families. These are actually whole families are being buried under the rubble of these destroyed buildings or residential blocks in the north of Gaza. More explosive-laden reports are actually triggered in these very populated or densely populated areas in west of Gaza. Since the dawn of this morning until now, at least 5 explosive-laden reports were actually directed to the most densely populated areas in Tell el-Hawa in the south or the southwest of Gaza City. This actually is a tactic the Israeli occupation army is using against the civilians in the city of Gaza to terrorize them and to force them out towards the allegedly safe zones in the south of the city. However, the massacres are relentlessly continuous. The massacres are actually unabated and targeting the most vulnerable groups of people for sure. More people are still also dying and literally dying because of starvation and malnutrition. In the past 24 hours, at least 3 more people died because of starvation, and that includes also another child.
For the first time, UN investigators have formally declared the Israeli regime is perpetrating genocide in Gaza with the intent of destroying the Palestinian people residing there. UN Independent International Commission of Inquiry also implicated Israel's prime minister and other senior officials for their role in incitement. The commission released its most recent report nearly 2 years after launch of the Israeli genocidal campaign.
It is occurring in Gaza and is continuing to occur, and the responsibility lies with the state of Israel. We identified 3 persons in this report, and that is Prime Minister Netanyahu, the former Minister of Defense, Gallant, and the President of Israel, whose statements inciting genocide is recorded faithfully. So it's a 2-year work. It's not just something we made up now. And as we set out all the facts, and we looked at videos, footage, we talked to experts, we talked to doctors, witnesses, children. After that massive investigation, we are, of course, the only UN body that is authorized to investigate. We're not allowed inside Israel, so we had witnesses come out to us. So that's just a little bit about our methodology. So I want to stress how careful we were in reaching that conclusion. Because those 3 individuals acted as agents of the state, we hold the state of Israel responsible for genocide.
The Hamas resistance movement has strongly slammed the international community's failure to stop Israeli crimes in Gaza. The movement's statement came as Israel is pressing ahead with its military aggression in Gaza City, demolishing high-rise buildings and forcefully displacing residents. Hamas said fascist Israeli army's brutal aggression against Gaza City constitutes full-fledged crime of ethnic cleansing and genocide, adding regime continues to commit such crimes amid glaring international inaction and lack of decisive will on the part of the international community to stop them and hold the perpetrators to account. Hamas stressed Israel's crimes will fail to weaken the resolve of Palestinians, though, who will continue their resistance and make the occupying regime pay dearly for its horrendous crimes. Hamas warned Israel's war criminal prime minister bears full responsibility for the fate of captives held in Gaza, and he will not succeed in releasing them through his criminal policies. The Israeli prime minister has acknowledged the regime is facing increased isolation on the world stage. The acknowledgement comes amid massive international backlash against Tel Aviv over the genocide in Gaza.
So know that there is currently an attempt to impose a siege on Israel by various entities and countries, led by Qatar. First and foremost, a media siege funded by massive amounts of money from Qatar and other countries like China. They are operating in the West, and no less so in the United States. The second part is more focused, and it is centered in Western European countries, through the activation of Muslim minorities there, who are becoming vocal, violent and threatening the states. That's why we see this siege concentrating in Western Europe. As I said, arms shipments to us are being halted. This is happening now.
Benjamin Netanyahu was speaking at a finance ministry conference at Al-Quds. He said regime has no choice but to stand on its own and become less reliant on external trade in the face of growing isolation. Netanyahu said Israel's arms industries are blocked, adding regime needs to develop its own weapons industry. Opposition leader Yair Lapid reacted to Netanyahu's comments, saying isolation is a result of flawed and failed policy adopted by the Israeli prime minister. This as Spain has canceled a weapons contract worth hundreds of millions of euros with Israel over regime's ongoing onslaught on Gaza. The deal, worth nearly 700 million euros, would have seen Spain buying Israeli-designed rocket launchers from Elbit Systems. Move followed Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez's pledge to turn into law a ban on all military sales or purchase deals with Israel over the regime's atrocities in Gaza. Madrid has also scrapped another contract valued at 287 million euros to buy anti-tank missile launchers, which were to be manufactured under license from an Israeli company. On Monday, Sanchez also called for Israel to be barred from international sports over the Gaza war. He expressed deep admiration for thousands of protesters who forced the halt of the final stage of the Vuelta a España, one of the world's biggest cycling events, in Spain on Sunday. Professor Tim Anderson, director at the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies, joined us earlier to discuss Spain's military embargo decision.
Look, there's been a lot of inconsistencies in the Spanish government's approach here. They've been talking about the bans a lot while still carrying out business, but I think it's a welcome move, and there were already provisions in law for them to do it, which were breached, because Spain is a net importer of Israeli weapons systems, basically, and as you say, it amounts to about $1 billion in the last 2 years since the October 2023 outbreak in Gaza. But I think it's going to send a very good signal to other European countries, other Western countries, that this should be done and can be done, despite the inconsistencies of Spain's actual practice. He's moving in the right direction, you know. He's been criticized for these inconsistencies and the difference between rhetoric and action, but nevertheless, I think it's a laudable thing. And as I said, it's going to also have a flow-on effect to the rest of the European countries and other Western countries. So I don't think too much should be made about the criticisms. He has been consistent at a rhetorical level in his rejection of the Israeli genocide. They recognized Palestine as a nation last year, more than a year ago. So there's a slow progress but at least he's acting, because really what the world requires now is action from these governments that have been sponsoring or engaged in trade with the Israelis to tighten this boycott. And I think it's we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that it's a very welcome move, and it's catching up in practice what he's been saying in rhetoric for quite some time now.
Luxembourg will join a number of European nations in recognizing the state of Palestine at the upcoming UN General Assembly as outrage has grown over Israel's genocide in Gaza. Prime Minister Luc Frieden and Foreign Minister Xavier Bettel communicated the decision to a parliamentary commission. They asserted the move is being coordinated with several other European Union member states, including France and Belgium. Last week, the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen confirmed EU executive will suspend payments to the Israeli regime and impose sanctions on extremist ministers and violent Israeli settlers. Decisions are part of EU's broader reassessment of its relations with the Israeli regime in light of the ongoing genocide in Gaza. Nearly a dozen members of the European Union have already recognized the state of Palestine. The Global Samud Flotilla has commenced a final leg of its journey to war-torn Gaza, with the objective of breaking Israel's prolonged blockade of the region. In the past few days, several vessels have departed from ports in Greece, Tunisia, and Italy to join the mission. The flotilla originally set sail from Spain in late August and has already encountered two suspected Israeli attacks. Journalist and activist Fra Hughes, who's aboard the flotilla, joined us earlier with some details for us.
Our focus is purely on reaching Gaza. We continue to watch the evisceration of human lives. We continue to watch people being murdered simply trying to access food. We're watching the destruction of the further destruction of the infrastructure. We're witnessing 1.7, 1.8 million people who are surviving a living hell. Everyone on the flotilla is determined to get to Gaza. It is our determination under the Fourth Geneva Convention and under international law to create a maritime lifeline to Gaza. So the only people, no one will stop us except the fascists at sea. If that happens, we will deal with the challenge. Our hearts are with the people in Gaza. Our boats will hopefully be with the people in Gaza. Our aid will be with the people of Gaza. And just remember, any violence that happens on the flotilla will be a direct result of the fascist stormtroopers of the Knesset if they use violence in order to stop the flotilla. We are non-violent. We are peaceful. This is a humanitarian lifeline to Gaza, and we intend to fulfill our mission.
In recent weeks, the U.S. has been attacking boats near Venezuela, claiming vessels are involved in the drug trafficking trade. U.S. military has also so far struck two of those vessels, second of which was announced by President Donald Trump on Monday. Earlier the same day, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro held a press conference in response to Washington's provocations. He said what's happening is not simple political tensions between the two nations, but U.S. acts of aggression against Venezuela.
This is not tension, it is outright aggression, judicial aggression when they criminalize us, political aggression with their daily threatening statements, diplomatic aggression, and ongoing military aggression. Venezuela is empowered by international law to comprehensively confront this aggression. It is not tension, it is aggression. Today, I can announce that communications with the U.S. government are severed. They are severed by them with their threats of bombs, death, and blackmail. We do not operate under threats. With intimidation, there will never be anything, and they know it. So they have moved from a stage of strained communication to none at all, and history will continue. For a destroyer to send missile experts to assault tuna boats, you know what they were looking for. I don't even need to say it. They were seeking a military incident. If our tuna fishermen had any weapons and used them in Venezuelan waters, it would have been the military incident the warmongers, the extremists who want war in the Caribbean, are seeking. I ask Washington, who gave the order to create this incident. It must be in the operational orders. Who in Washington gave that order?
China has condemned the U.S. for expanding sanctions on Chinese entities despite a series of economic consultations with Beijing.
The U.S. side has overstretched the concept of national security, growing the sanctions list on Chinese entities and stretching longer and longer its long-arm jurisdiction. Such typical unilateral bullying practice violates international law and basic principles underpinning international relations. The Chinese side firmly opposes this and has raised our solemn concerns in our meeting with the U.S. over these issues.
Li emphasized outcomes of recent trade and economic discussions was a result of considerable effort, and he urged the United States to respect the consultation process. The Chinese minister asserted that Washington cannot expect Beijing to address its concerns while simultaneously imposing restrictions on Chinese enterprise. Li called upon the U.S. to promptly lift restrictive measures and collaborate with China to preserve progress attained through bilateral dialogue. The remarks come after a fourth round of Sino-U.S. negotiations in Madrid. The U.S. continues its tariff pressure and sanctions, including efforts by the Trump administration to increase duties on China and India for purchasing Russian oil. And this brings us, everyone, to the end of your news bulletin. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. Welcome to another enlightening episode of Islamic Upbringing, where we dive deep into the essential aspects of nurturing your youth in line with Islamic teachings. In this program, our discussions are rooted in the guidance of the Holy Quran and the timeless wisdom of Hadith from our beloved Prophet Muhammad, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon him and his purified family, and the insightful narratives of our noble Imams. I'm glad to have with us today Brother Muhammad Liaqat Abbas, a research scholar from the Seminary of Qom, who possesses a wealth of knowledge in both Islamic studies as well as psychology. So, Brother Liaqat Abbas, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum salam, sister.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you so much.
So, I want to ask you, why is it important to instill the values, the beliefs of, like, say, for example, Ghadir, the beliefs of Muharram itself, the beliefs of Karbala, to instill them at an early stage?
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. So, instilling correct beliefs is very important because the child will take up that path. Example, if you teach Ghadir from a very, very small age, which is wajib upon you, yeah, because the Prophet has said, I'm going to teach you, like I'm telling you, you have to tell the ghaib, you have to tell those who
are absent.
Are absent over here. Like it's a wazifa, it's a responsibility. Our responsibility or obligations are not just namaz or fasts or hajj and khums and that's it, it's done.
Any important message?
Yeah, example, this is also wajib, like this is also obligatory upon a parent to teach about Ghadir, what had happened in Ghadir.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, example, with regards to Ghadir, with regards to Muharram, what had happened in the month of Muharram, what had happened on the day of Ashura, example, there are, like, I would say millions and millions of lessons in Ashura itself, in in Ghadir itself, like the sermon of Ghadir, if you see,
mm-hmm.
it's not just Man Kuntu Mawlahu Fahaza Ali and Mawlah.
It was a yeah? 3-hour sermon.
Yeah, exactly. Of course, like the 3-hour sermon is also dissected. Why it took 3 hours, you know about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, example, in those days, there was no mic, you know, and there were these mukabbirin, or there were these people who used to stand between the people, and they used to act as loudspeakers, of course.
Like,
yeah, the Prophet would say something, and the first one would shout the same thing, and the second one, like the at a distance, would shout the same thing which he had heard.
Mm-hmm.
Like this, a public which is like of 100,000 people would be conveyed the message. So you see, like people will be kept at different intervals,
mm-hmm.
so that the message is passed on to everyone at that particular time itself. So this is how the whole sermon of Ghadir reached all those 100,000 people. And anyways, like instilling the message of Ghadir, instilling the message of Karbala, Ashura, instilling the message of Arba'een helps the child take the path of Ghadir, take the path of Karbala, take the path of Arba'een. Why is Arba'een established? Why are we taking Arba'een as an important occasion in our lives, example?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the child will try to know more about it. From the early childhood, the positive or the plus point is the child gets into the path already. It's mm-hmm. not like he is adopting it in his later life.
Right.
He's used to it. Now that the child grows like towards his 15s or 20s, the child knows it even more. The child is already in the path. Alhamdulillah, we all try that our children get on the path of Ashura, get on the path of Karbala and Ghadir, example. Alhamdulillah, which is a good thing. And of course, this, the concepts of Ghadir, the beliefs of Ghadir and Ashura or Karbala,
right.
yeah, they teach us love and loyalty to Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because now that we are, example, we consider Ghadir in our lives,
mm-hmm.
it is considered that we are loyal towards the Ahlul Bayt. We consider Ashura in our lives, we are counted amongst those who are loyal to Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
Right. Let's take a short break and learn more.
Give thanks to Allah for the moon and the stars. Praise Him all day for what is and what was. Take hold of your iman. Don't give in to shaitan. Oh, you who believe, please give thanks to Allah. Allahu Ghafoor, Allahu Rahim, Allahu Yuhibbul Muhsinin, Wa Khaliquna, Wa Rasiquna, Wa Huwa Ala Kulli Shay'in Qadir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. Brother Liaquat Abbas has been teaching us that why is it important to instill the concepts like Qadir, the concepts like Karbala at the early stage of a child. Well, you said that it's not just talking about some belief to them, but it's talking about loyalty. It's talking about obedience. For example, when we talk about the concept of Qadir, for example, and when you accept that concept, when you accept that belief, it's obedience, right? Teaches obedience. And then again, in terms of Karbala, it teaches loyalty. So yeah, I would like to break it down more.
Yeah. So when we talk about Ghadir itself, the child from a very young age knows that Imam Ali alayhi salam is the correct and the rightful successor of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam. And after him are the noble and the righteous imams who are the rightful caliphs after Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam.
Right.
Later on, when you give them the reason, they would understand it even better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now that you have told them, oh, you know what? This is the rightful caliph in his age, like in his era. Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam is the rightful successor and the rightful caliph.
Right.
Yeah. And after him is Imam Hassan and then Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam. And when you speak about Ashura, he will understand the connection between Ghadir and Ashura. Oh,
right.
It started from Ghadir. And this Imam, who is the third Imam, alayhi salam.
Now, since people forgot Ghadir, so Karbala took place.
Oh, yes, definitely. Definitely. Yeah, definitely. This is there. That's the reason you have to try to connect the concepts together younger age itself. You know what? Because it happened in Ghadir, because they went up against Imam Ali alayhi salam. They went against Imam Hassan. They went against Imam Hussein alayhi salam. So you see how Ashura is connected to Ghadir? Mm-hmm. The child would start to understand. Oh, okay, fine. So this is how it happened. So that's the reason we accept Ghadir. So we accept the wilaya of Imam Hassan alayhi salam, and also we accept the wilaya of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, the authority, the leadership. And because we accept the leadership of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, something has happened to him will definitely cause us hurt, and it will definitely cause us to bring tears in our eyes. Mm-hmm. That's the reason. This is one of the reasons we cry upon Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam. And bringing this concept like, oh, you know what? You're not just crying because he has suffered. You're crying because your wali, like who is like the highest form of authority, has gone through this hardship. It's not just the hardship. Because you have an inner connection. You have a beautiful connection with your imam, with your wali, with the one who is in authority. Yeah. So explaining everything and connecting the dots help your child learn more better. Unfortunately, we take them to Ghadir and that's it, it's done. We take them to the Majalis. And if the scholar who comes over there, if he doesn't join the dots, like you also don't join the dots. It shouldn't be
so
like
So you're
this.
Saying that taking them to a gathering, taking them to a celebration, taking them to some Majalis, won't do much as long as you're not connecting the dots of the history.
Definitely. Yes. So joining the dots, of history is extremely important.
So this is a time to ponder. Mm-hmm. We'll take a short break and we'll be back.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam said, raise your children to have three features: love for your Prophet, love for his household, and reciting the Quran.
Welcome back. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. Brother Liaquat Abbas is telling us, why is it important from an early childhood to be taught the concepts of Ghadir, to be taught the concepts of Karbala, Ashura, and also, like I would say, the concept of Mahdawiyat.
Yep.
And then you said connecting the dots is one of the most important things that parents have to be doing while teaching the beliefs.
Yep.
It's not just you're taking them to these gatherings, to the celebrations, to the mourning ceremonies and all. It's also like you yourself connect the dots of the history and make a path clear for them ahead.
Yep. Actually, this question of yours is a beautiful question. Like, how do we as parents instill the concept of Mahdawiyya, or
mm-hmm.
the love of Imam al-Mahdi, ajallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif, in young questions, in the young children? It's a beautiful question. Inshallah, we'll keep it for another session, I would say. As of now, inshallah, like teaching them these concepts like Mahdawiyya and like Karbala, Ashura, Arba'een, Fatimiyya. Right now, the Ayyam Fatimiyya is something which is seen in today's world. Yeah, unfortunately, in the olden days or the olden era,
it was not so
it
vibrant.
It was not. Yeah, exactly. So concept of Fatimiyya, and if you would bring the concept of Muhsiniyya as well, with regards to the Shahadat of Hazrat Muhsin ibn Ali alayhi salatu wasalam. Anyway, so bringing these kind of concepts will bring a spiritual connection with the person, or like with the Imam, or with the infallible who is connected with that occasion. Example, like Ghadir with Imam Ali alayhi salam, and a sense of spiritual connection bonds up between your child and Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam. If you teach your child about Ghadir or the special occasion in the very young age itself, likewise with Ashura or Arbaeen, the spiritual connection is bonded now, is built.
It's reminding me of a joke. Like, there was this clip that was very, very viral, where a very young child, while he was being injected, and he was saying, "Ali, Ali, Ali, I have never been used to injections. Ali, please help me. Ali, please be with me." So yeah, it was like how much this child has developed this connection with Imam Ali alayhi salam, that in the time of pain, in the time of loneliness, in the time of like that fear, he's only calling him, and like that of a friend. Like, he was not
exactly.
Yeah, he was saying that way. So it was like very, very amazing to see. At the same time, amazing for his parents as well.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And it can also bring tears in the eyes of the parents. Wow, mashallah, like, my child is calling out to Imam Ali alayhi salam during his tough time. So, yeah, of course. And you know what? When the spiritual connection is formed, the bond is formed, then slowly, slowly, the qualities of the one with whom the spiritual connection is formed starts to come inside the child itself. So, inshallah, may Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala give us the tawfiq to teach our children about Ghadir, to teach our children about Ashura, Arba'een, Fatimiyya, Mahdawiyya, the concepts which are related to the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam,
inshallah. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, he will reward your efforts, definitely. Thank you, brother, for those valuable insights. Thank you, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another episode, take very good care of yourselves and stay connected to IRIB English Radio. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.
Naqsh-e Jahan Square, one of the biggest and most beautiful squares in the world. A UNESCO World Heritage Site that must be on your bucket list. Naqsh Jahan Square is located in the center of the city of Isfahan. It was built during the 17th century, during the Safavid era. This square, with its rich historical background, is one of the most spectacular attractions of the city of Isfahan. On the western side of Naqsh Jahan Square, you find an exquisite palace, which is known as Ali Qapu. It was built during the Safavid era, and it was considered the political center of the country. Ali Qapu literally means Great Gate. The palace is actually a six-story building, but you won't realize this until you go to the backyard. It was here that the Safavid king would entertain his special visitors. He also celebrated Nowruz, the Persian New Year.
We've just been to the palace. It's absolutely beautiful. We went up the staircase to the number of levels and just saw the amazing decorative artwork, and then went up to the top chamber where we believe the musicians used to play, the amazing acoustics.
This amazing structure is rich in wall paintings. The doors, walls, and ceilings are highly ornamented with intricately designed floral motifs. On the sixth floor is where royal receptions were held and was referred to as the music hall. One of the main attractions of Naqsh Jahan Square are the mosques that are located in it. Mosques that are not only considered masterpieces of Iranian Islamic architecture, but that are famous for their tile works. Imam Mosque, also known as Jame Abbasi Mosque, is on the south side of the square. It is considered an excellent example of the Islamic era architecture of Iran. Its splendor is mainly due to the beauty of its seven-color tiles. Probably the most amazing part of this mosque is its tile works. The tiles are so intricately designed that you can even find postcards and replicas of them around the square. The magnificent tile work serves a double function. Aside from ornamenting the mosque, there was a need to weatherproof the simple clay bricks used in its construction. The tiles are decorated in seven colors, which is why they are called haftrang, which literally means seven colors.
It's absolutely beautiful. It's so big and colourful. And what else, Dan?
Yeah, the tiles and the decorations are amazing, aren't they? Yeah.
You can find one of the most exquisite masterpieces of Iranian architecture, Sheikh Lutfullah Mosque, which was built by Shah Abbas I of the Safavid dynasty.
Fascinates me most about this mosque is, first of all, architecturally it's a unique work. You don't have anything like that in any part of Iran or elsewhere, because it's a private mosque built for the father-in-law of Shah Abbas the Great. In terms of ornament, what fascinates me most is the interplay of natural tile colors with various sorts of blue color in these in the whole composition. The composition of natural tile color with blue, that's unique and that's very nice.
I can't tell you enough about the beauty of Sheikh Lutfullah Mosque, but in my opinion, the most amazing part is the tile work under the dome. And if you're familiar with Persian carpets, you will find this design quite familiar.
Mm-hmm.
The Bazaar of Isfahan is one of the oldest and largest bazaars in the Middle East. Some parts of it are more than 1,000 years old. The bazaar is abundant in handicrafts, so if you're looking for a little something to take back, this is where you need to go.
One of the most interesting parts of Naqsh-e Jahan Square is Qaisariya Bazaar, one of the longest bazaars in the world that connects Naqsh-e Jahan Square to Atiq Square. It's about 8 kilometers long.
The square is still as vibrant as it was, today mostly with the presence of tourists rather than merchants. But it is still reminiscent of its days of glory, when public ceremonies were held, Nowruz was celebrated, and polo games were played.
Now, after all of these amazing things, there's only one thing I can say. Visiting Naqsh-e Jahan Square must be on your bucket list.
Gisumisha Ahmadi for Iran.
Allah 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 Ya Rabbi Allah Allah Ya Rabbi Allah Allah Allah
Nothing in the world can ever turn their hearts away from the calm of surrender they find when they say,
Allah.
Good afternoon to all of our listeners. This is Iran Radio, broadcast from Tehran. I'm your presenter for the next hour. We start off this hour's programs with the Spotlight, a daily program which covers the most important events happening in the world today. After that, we have The Bridge. The program offers a brief commentary and presentation of the supplications of the Noble book, Sahifa Sajadia. Our varied radio productions feature will round up this hour's programs. Stay with us for this hour.
Us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. This is a watershed moment in the United States. At least that is what many political analysts are saying about the overall political environment in the country after conservative activist and podcaster Charlie Kirk was killed last week. Now, those on the right are accusing those on the left of declaring war on them, and many on the left are blaming the right for creating a violent and biased environment. There are many unanswered questions regarding Kirk's killing, but what is obvious is that the political divide in the U.S. is not only wide, but many may say it's fatal for the regime. We'll be taking a look at this on this Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Tony Gosling, historian and investigative journalist out of Bristol, U.K. And William Jones, political analyst out of Leesburg, out of the U.S. Thank you both for being with me. Let's start off with Tony. Your thoughts, Tony. Do you think that this is a watershed moment in the U.S.?
Well, look, his movement was called Turning Point, wasn't it? In fact, it could be that Charlie Kirk himself ends up being the turning point where many people on the Republican right side of U.S. politics start to wake up to, as Charlie was doing, the malign influence of the Israelis that they spend most of their time supporting the last decades on US politics. But I want to, I think, correct you describing Charlie, because he was a Christian leader. He wasn't an activist. He was a leader. He was a leader of thought, a leader of opinion. He wasn't really your standard Republican, so he was part of Trump's MAGA movement. So he was somebody who you could imagine in maybe 10, 15 years' time becoming part of the national leadership. This is, I think, one of the most disturbing things about this assassination is the fact that Charlie was he was going places. And the other thing is he was adapting. His ideas were adapting to the facts. So he wasn't rigidly pro-Israel. He has been for many years. But over the last few months, he's been, for example, questioning whether there was a deliberate stand down of the Israeli Defense Forces, the IDF, the army, on October the 7th, 2023. He's openly saying, I think that that's a question that they've got to answer. He's doing many other things to question Netanyahu's wisdom of the Gaza genocide policy. He started calling it a genocide. He started calling it ethnic cleansing. So he was somebody who was his own man. And, of course, we don't like that in the West. We like to have politicians that have one set opinion and stick to it. And, by the way, what they the elite in the West really love is a politician like Starmer who will just read out any script that is put in front of him and doesn't have any set of opinions. Charlie Kirk represented the absolute opposite of that, someone with a conscience, a committed Christian who kept Christian values. That's the values of Jesus Christ. Anti-abortion, all these sorts of things. And he actually debated with people who were supporters of the Church of Satan. saying that, look, you know, abortion is wrong, especially up until very close to the time of birth. It's wrong under any circumstances. And our duty as human beings is to protect these unborn children. We were all once one of them ourselves. These are the sorts of values that Charlie represented. And I think that's why he was assassinated. That's why he was murdered, whether it was an organized assassination or, as we saw, I think possibly with the attempt to kill Trump, there was a climate had been created around this idea that this guy is a fascist, a Nazi, a load of smear campaigns circulated through the mainstream press and on social media that then wound individuals up to think, well, it's going to be a good thing. I'm going to be cool with my mates if I go and kill this so-called fascist. So I think that's really where we are with Charlie, a very, very important assassination that could indeed turn events in the United States to recognize that, no, it's no good for the MAGA and the Republican part or any of the Americans to be supporting the Israeli genocide.
All right. Well, William, your thoughts on that. And who do you think benefits, if anyone, from the killing of Charlie Kirk?
Well, I don't know that anyone really benefits from it. I do think it is a watershed moment in a much different way than the previous speaker. It's really a watershed moment for the ability of the American Republic to continue as a republic. There are a lot of divided opinions today. There's always diversity within the American political body. Nevertheless, things have become, because of internet, because of everything, all kinds of information, misinformation being put out on the social media, that emotions can be revved up to a point that lead to such a violent encounter. And I think people are beginning to understand this now. Everybody, of course, is playing it, you know, in their own way for political reasons. But I think the basic ideas, the basic lessons of that were pointed out by the governor of Utah in a speech that he made when they announced that they had caught the killer, where he appealed to the American people to come together to deal with their differences in the open public forum, to discuss the issues, to lay out the facts, and to do it with a sense of comity and with a sense that that we are living in one nation and have somehow got to work together. That's going to be a difficult task going in because of the intensity of the divergences that have occurred over the last 5 to 10 years in the political arena. But this is the only way that you can avoid chaos going forward. It will be a difficult task, but it's really the future of the American Republic as a democracy in which people themselves have the ability both to express what they feel and what they believe, but also in such a way that they are not becoming targets of another part of the political spectrum, which want to eliminate them physically. And I think we have to begin to, I think most Americans are beginning to think of this in terms of, you know, not so much of vengeance, of getting back at alleged enemies. And as far as we can see, this individual who did the killing, we don't know what he was motivated about. We don't know his view on the issue of Israel. We don't know his view on maybe on the view of LGBT, which was also a part of this. We don't know what his views were. But I think in asserting that this somehow is, you know, is a move in a political game, I think that's just not the case. Other people were convinced that it had something to do with the Ukraine war, that the victim had been very outspoken in trying to get the United States to leave Ukraine and to find a resolution of this, and some people don't like that. But I think it's much more complicated, and we have to leave it to the investigators to see what happened. But I think the lessons for Americans now are to find a way in which we can come back to a situation in which we can discuss our differences, in which we can resolve them in a peaceful way to avoid these kind of things from happening in the future.
Okay, well, Tony, How likely is this to affect the overall political, future political environment in the United States?
Yeah, good question, because I think what we're seeing is with this decapitation, these sorts of assassinations, political assassinations, really the entire FBI in the United States, MI5 in Britain, and in other European countries all have their internal security services that are supposed to be there to make sure things like this never happen. They are the political police. They're supposed to be the political police. But I think what we're seeing now with the attempted assassination of Donald Trump last year in July, and this now possibly the suspect they've got, Tyler Robinson, for murdering and assassinating Charlie Kirk. These individuals, I mean, what's happening is this same policy that we've been seeing, in other words, the assassinations of political and military leaders in Russia, political and military leaders in Palestine, in Iran, the destruction of many of the senior individuals, including journalists, etc., in Yemen just last week. The idea that these institutions which keep a country stable, its press, its democratic politics, etc., that they are, it's an open season on these. Yes, absolutely right. This is a chaos agenda. But the thing is, we've been used over the last couple of years of seeing the Israelis and others perpetrating this over in the Middle East. And it now looks as if that same mentality is coming back to the United States. I mean, it's a while since we saw high-level political assassination attempts like that of John F. Kennedy in the 1960s, which turns out to have been connected with, actually within the United States, with the FBI, etc. And the main motivation seems to be towards the stopping of the... Because Kennedy wanted to stop the Vietnam War, etc., and he wanted Lyndon Johnson in. There is a very interesting documentary by Laurent Guillenot which calls Israel and the assassination of the Kennedy brothers, which says that Kennedy was trying to stop the Israelis getting Kennedy was trying to stop the Israelis getting nuclear technology at the time. So what I'm saying is, I do think is, I mean, we've heard from the Grey Zone, for example, that Netanyahu was trying to fund Charlie Kirk. Charlie Kirk refused the money from Netanyahu because he thought that it was tainted. He was starting to turn away, and it's rather disgusting to see Netanyahu put across Charlie Kirk as some sort of Israeli martyr when actually the opposite is the truth. Charlie Kirk was turning away from his support of Israel completely, Marcia. And so I think, again, the main problem here is we cannot allow, none of our security services can allow this kind of encouragement of young people to go out assassinating in the West. It's extremely